So welcome. Lovely to see all of you, and I'm particularly pleased to have Zora Husseini and Virinder Lamba. Long time conversation partners of mine, people that I have had the pleasure of thinking with now for more than just a few years. I'm not going to say much by way of introduction to them. I think you will get plenty of that when you listen and engage them in conversation. Zora did graduate with a PhD here at the University of Alberta in sociology, sort of, yes. In a manner of speaking.
Thank you for remembering.
And she has written a number of books, including recently been involved in several books associated with women's religious lives. As you will no doubt come to see, she has done substantial work in the whole area of Islam and human rights, cares deeply about it, and thinks profoundly about it. Virinder Lamba is an engineer by profession, and has been a part of various interfaith organizations, one which was struck here a number of years ago that we were both on, associated with the Human Rights Commission, and more recently with the Edmonton Interfaith Educational Society, of which Zora is also a... Come in. Don't be afraid. We do bite, but it never hurts much for very long. We wanted to spend a little time with you thinking about the antidotes to fear. What are the religious sources that perhaps we can give more attention to, that may be a little bit of an antidote to fear? So I'd like Zora to begin and Virinder to follow, following that, if that's okay. And then I'll say a few things and we'll talk together about these matters.
Thank you, David, for giving me this opportunity to come and share some of my thoughts with these thoughtful and distinguished audience. David has asked me to talk about Islam and Muslims in the context of climate of fear and commitment to peace. So I'm going to confine my remarks only to talk about Islam, because many people have talked and will talk about other themes. The second thing is that if what I say appears to you to be simplistic, it is mainly because the subject is too complex. And in order to manage it, I have had to simplify it to its some basic concepts. I don't know at what stage David would allow questions, but as far as I am concerned, please stop and ask if you need anything. Now, as we know, many religious sources have been used to create fear among minds of its followers. The fear is created not only of others portrayed as threat, but also fear of God, of punishment by God, of hell, and other kinds of dire consequences of one's bad actions. As a result, human mind gets accustomed to not only anticipate fear in many situations, but also gets prone to be prepared to meet it. And in that state of mind, it becomes very conducive to accepting the reality and also rumors that evoke fears. In Islam also, this way is used to create fear. Both as if you do this, God will be angry, And also, if you do not do this, then God will be displeased. I heard it as I was growing up in a Muslim household in India. In my house, mostly, these kinds of sayings were used to instill considerateness and care in children. You hurt so-and-so. Aren't you afraid of God? Don't you fear God and the consequences if you hurt others? Now, religion was followed, but it was not oppressive in my parents' home, who were practicing and humanist Muslims. Nothing was imposed upon me, thank God. But that was not the case in majority of Muslim homes. They were where religion was imposed on the children. And children and adults were always supposed to remember and fear the wrath of God. And that kind of religious philosophy or religious education puts a very harsh face on Islam and religion, and God is portrayed as a transcendent being, authoritarian male figure, in the figure of an authoritarian male. So just imagine what would Muslim women feel. Now, a combination of such saying and many other incentive lead people, young and old, men and women, not only to live in fear, but commit acts of tyranny out of fear. The scriptures and other secondary theological and sometimes doubtful sources were quoted to support the claims made by the priests or imams about object of fear, whether it was God.
We talk about the intricacies of interpretations of our scriptures beyond our capability. We cannot interpret scriptures unless we raise our level of consciousness to Muhammad, to Jesus. Only then we can interpret their what they said. We do not want to even listen to them when they all say, love thy neighbor. What is big deal about that? We cannot follow that. You tell me. Why can't we do a simple thing like that, generate love and radiate out, rather than saying, okay, I want love. No, you don't get love from there anywhere. You have to generate inside and then radiate. And if it doesn't work, then come to me and crucify me. Honestly. That is the thing that we have to worry about. Very simple things. Start at the most simplest of all, which we don't have to explain, which we don't have to interpret, which we don't have to translate in many languages. And the language of love, we know there is no such language. It's action. Making our life easy. You know, I can quote lots of antidotes from my scriptures, but they won't mean anything. They won't mean anything. I can try to cure a patient, but patient has to be willing to cooperate with me. I cannot do against patient's will. The patient's will lies in the fact that he or she will take the medicine regularly, religiously. We all read our scriptures every morning and evening and during the day. But as soon as we finish reading, we are into a different world altogether. Why? Are we gone mad? What's wrong with us? What is wrong with us? We call so-called modern society as compared to the old ancient non-civilized societies, yet we cannot even follow our roadmap? I don't call this a civilized society. I think we are the most ignorant people of any century. Having seen the wars and the misery and the turning from one human to the other for the last 5,000 years, and we have not learned a thing yet. And we call ourselves wise species on this earth. How many monkeys have made the atomic bombs and killed hundreds of thousands of monkeys?
Virendra, may I ask, is it all right to ask you something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I see the title here is Antidotes to Fear, a Conversation on Religious Capacity. As I mentioned to you at break time, one of my nephews is half Sikh. And he has chosen to attend a Pentecostal church in British Columbia. And he's horrified to think that I would even be speaking with you, for example, who looks like an Orthodox Sikh. Mm-hmm. How can I help him to embrace his heritage, to be proud of his heritage? Maybe this is too simple. Maybe this is too simple. What is he afraid of? What is his... How can I help him develop his religious capacity?
Well, any fear, I guess we are not willing to give up what we possess. We hesitate to give up what we possess because we hold it so dear to us. We think that it's going to be the end of our life. Whatever his possessions are, we have to let them go. We have to let our possessions go, including our wisdom, because our wisdom is a proof that it hasn't taken us anywhere. We have to let a lot of things go, which we, and then when we do that, then there's no difference whether I go to a church or a mosque or a gurdwara or anywhere. I see no difference. I will go to any gurdwara or any masjid, any church. So the thing is to have what we possess, be willing to get rid of it. Be willing to let it go. And the problem today is that's what's happening. We are not willing to let our... we have the five vices, we call. There's lust. There's anger. Okay. There's greed. There's attachment. And finally, the ego. Yeah. Those five vices are so dear to us. Take one at a time. Either one, anyone, take one, anyone, doesn't matter what. The others will follow. Once we have learned how to get rid of anger, the greed will disappear. The lust will disappear. Or vice versa. So if we start to learn how to get rid of greed, the anger will disappear. But learn just one another. Look at our society. Look at our economic system, so-called the bottom line system. Have you noticed some changes in the last 10, 15 years? Have you noticed that the change in the services, what we used to get 20 years, 15 years ago and now? Why? What happened? The economics says you produce more numbers for me. Meaningless numbers. You know, I have X number of those numbers in the bank. Those numbers. And what happened to those numbers when one of the bombs strikes? Where did the numbers go? Where do I go? What happened? Or simply when I go, what happens to those numbers? They're here. We're attached to it. Now, same thing with, okay, I was talking to the economic theory. Look at the economic theory. Economic theory of the modern man is based on greed and exploitation of man. Isn't this criminal? Isn't this unethical? To say that I will sell you this goods or services if anybody doesn't pay me any more. If you pay me more, I'll sell you. And you said, no, I will pay you more. Okay, I'll sell you. What kind of ethics is that?
Capitalism.
Whatever we call it. It's unethical. Whatever it is. And that theory is so tightly held by us, we don't want to let it go, and we want to convince people that's the only way today's world is going to work. And people go along with it and say, yeah, okay, I'll go along with it. As long as I get my bread and, you know, for daily living, we are happy. I'm not trying here any revolution, but I'm trying here to wake up our consciousness. We have to wake up our conscience. We are going through such a big dream, we don't even know the reality. Go to into that stage. Have you ever experienced when you're dreaming something and you all of a sudden realize that, oh no, this is just a dream. I'll get out of it. Have you? Isn't that beautiful? The biggest danger we see in that dream, and we are not afraid of, because we know that we're going to get out of that dream. Why can't we apply that in our life? That in the dream, when we wake up, that is our consciousness waking up. And if we raise our consciousness in this so-called dream, we will see it a dream, and we will laugh at each other. What we were talking about, this was just a dream. I'm pretty sure when we all go to upstairs, heaven, or whatever the other place is, we laugh there. We say, look what we did down there. We were each other's throat for nothing. So we have to get up, get out of the unconsciousness, and the clock is going so fast. We have to get out of the consciousness, unconsciousness, and into consciousness. And unless we do that, and there are every scripture in this world, we don't have to interpret that deeply to get into consciousness, and we don't have to argue with anybody. You interpret that way, good. Are you getting out of the unconsciousness? Good for you. You do it. I am getting out of that unconsciousness through this interpretation. It's working. What else do you need? Why do we fight over little things when we are letting go the big things unsolved? Why don't we get simple? Why do we complicate our life?
So do you want to walk into that?
Well, that's great, Varinder. I just think everything you've said was said 2,500 years ago by the Buddha. But basically what it is, isn't it, is that we are so concerned about everybody else except ourselves.
Exactly.
And our only job is to clear ourselves, and the rest will take care of itself.
That radiation of love, when you feel it, when you experience it, it's a wonderful feeling.
How do you foster it? How do you experience it?
You have
what ways, what means?
Letting it go is one way. Letting everything
what happens,
but
happens.
Yeah, letting everything go. What happens in a way? I'm not saying that okay, you sit down and sleep all day and do nothing. You know, that's something that we have to do. But while doing that, don't be part of it. Be observer. Observe it. When we start observing things, we don't attach any labels to them. We become impartial.
Do you really mean observe, Virinder? Or do you mean be present to it?
Without
an appetite.
That's what I mean by present.
Without an appetite.
Yeah.
Without the need to replicate it.
Exactly. Be
as
present.
Observe sounds like you're removed from it.
And
I know you too well
you know
to know that that's
you know
not
my,
the case.
You know my English vocabulary is not as good as Punjabi.
It's terrific.
But there is a tradition, and there are meditations to do it, where we become the observer, which means our ego, our personality, is not attached to what's going on, and that observer self is really our God self, our higher self. But I was just going to say that you asked the question, how do we foster it? And
young people speak.
And I think that you answered it in part when you were giving your things you see as hope, and one of them was Sufism, which is mysticism and the practices. And I think what I'm coming to understand is that there are practices within all the traditions that you can look at it from a physics point of view and say it raises our vibrations. You can look at it and you can put it in other language and say it's metaphysical. It opens our heart. It opens our wisdom faculty. And that kind of transformation that, I mean, I'm so happy with what you said, when you open that, is transforming our consciousness is really the only hope. We have ultimately, which doesn't mean the other things aren't also helpful, but we have tried political systems, every world religion, probably every church within it often starts with a true, you know, not always, but often with a motive and with higher consciousness and an intimacy with the divine, and then it gets all into priestcraft and egotism and power politics. We've tried every system going. And I really think that planetary transformation, as you said, Harry, begins with personal transformation, which we do not do ourselves. We do practices and have the intent and live in community where we learn love, and then it is a grace or whatever other language you want to use. But I really think it's the most important factor.
I appreciate what's been shared here, but for me, kind of an alarm bell has been going off the last few minutes that we're very much privileged here. And I remember Buckminster Fuller said in the early 70s, it won't be the atom bomb or the nuclear bomb, it'll be the population bomb. I think the calling to groups like ourselves is Jeffrey Sachs, that while people are unfed and don't have clean water, we can talk and have self-awareness in our very special North America, but I think, well, people, what you're speaking of interpretation and very powerful hierarchies are affecting millions of people without food and water, without parents, and it sometimes feels overwhelming, you know, in its complexity. But again, as we march forward in our little steps in our gardens, as Olivia was saying this morning, you know, perhaps Jeffrey Sachs' call of getting to that 0.7% will make an impact on some of these more self-awareness concepts when there's food on people's table and clean water. So I feel slightly bubbled here right now in the conversation of the extreme poverty of, I think, these extreme nations, be they Christian fundamentalists or Muslim, are many times, from my reading, are going into countries and providing people with basic needs. And, you know, there's a huge calling for us to do more.
Roberto?
Yeah, the question that Sora asked about fostering this this thing that supposedly is to come out of us. But you were talking about how to foster it in others, right? Not so much within us, but humans have this interest in educating the young, for example. We have that natural interest in caring for others, the other generation. Now, is that part of the giving myself up, not wanting to foster this in others? Do you know what I'm saying?
You're asking me a question?
Like, I think that's part of what Sora was asking. Do we, how do we foster this? It can come out of me, to the new generation, let's say.
We generate in ourselves.
How do you foster the lack of ego?
See, to foster on the others, we foster on ourselves first. What comes out is automatically will be reflected to the others. You don't have to even talk sometimes. You walking down the street, you will influence the people, depending on how much you have fostered yourself. Every word you utter will have effect on the people. So the key is to foster on ourselves first and fully. The rest of it, God will take care of it through us. So don't worry about fasting on others. It will happen. How did Mother Teresa foster love? How did she do that? Did she teach schools? Yet the love she fostered is ever living. Without a single word.
In my experience with Sikhism until now, I'm always impressed with the Sikh understanding of provision and equality. Like in the Langar ceremonies, how everyone is equal and everyone has enough. I was wondering if you could comment on the Sikh understanding of equality and how, although yes, we have to focus on ourselves, what that means as a community in response to fear and poverty.
On equality?
The fact that I'm never served first when I go to the Gurudwara.
Because you're in the second in the line, so I'm be in the first in the line. Equality is reality. I mean, you can't argue with it. That's fundamental. If the inequality is a dream, which is unreality,
it's a fabrication.
It's illusion of our mind.
Except which that those who are unequal, who feel it, know it, suffer it.
Yeah, of course. They will not suffer if we foster that equality in ourselves and are ready to die for it. Now, that's a new term, but probably not going to be understood properly, is the fact that dying means, again, is giving up your whole thing. If I want everybody to be equal, I have to put in a lower position, because I know my ego tells me that I'm above certain amount of certain people. I have to kill my ego and tell the ego, no, I'm not. What makes me think that I'm above other people? What? The brain is not mine, even though it's attached to this body. But the possession, whose possession is it? The consciousness, the spirit. I mean, what sense is the body? Who is I? What is I when you say, okay, this is my body? Well, is it? Can you look after it? you know, we eat something, do we know how to digest? Who does that? When we have a heart attack, how come we can't repair it and say, oh, get back? If it's my, it's not mine. Something else is what came behind it.
So you're pointing to the connection, that there's a kind of connection that exists, and a reliance. Our very life, we rely on that which we do not control.
That's right.
And I think Tiff's question to you about seek ways of cultivating, recognizing, first of all,
mm-hmm.
It also appears from the outside to be cultivating, but recognizing that all human beings are part of a common family.
Exactly.
So if the queen comes to the Gurudwara, it makes no difference when she gets fed.
Well, I guess they give her special socks. They are the only.
They will. They'll
they
do
did.
That.
I mean, Amherst. No, that's reality. And I
you're
think
kidding.
That, yes.
You really sinned against your own tradition.
I'm against
I'm very disappointed. We have to call this to an end, I'm afraid, and move back briefly for some refreshment and then to the final session.
We are waiting for your final remarks.
I'm afraid that the time is up. It really is.
We
can't. Well, I can give you a story, which maybe relates to this a little bit. It's a story from Russia about a bishop that on one occasion three young men come to him and request tonsuring. They want to be monks because they want to enter into the great struggle of giving up, the great struggle of letting go of their passions. So the bishop spends a little time with them and after 3 days decides to tonsure them. This happened. Tonsure them.
Okay.
Clip their hair. You can see I've had it done. By the deity. So he tonsures them and he tells them to go to the other side of the large lake and to build a little monastery and work out their salvation. So they leave and they go. And he forgets about them. He forgets 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 10 years. 15, 20 years, until he's an old man. And then he remembers. What have I done? I forgot about them. What's happened to them? Have they lived out their spiritual life? They're under my omophorium, under his authority, and I've completely abandoned them. They were my spiritual children. What's happened to them? So he gets in the boat and he takes the journey. And at close to evening, he sees a fire up on the hillside. He goes into a little bay and he walks up and he sees them, three ragtag old men now, living in extremely humble circumstances. And as he comes up to them, they see him, they are so happy to see him, but they don't even know how to properly greet him. So he wonders about that, but they're ready to break the fast that they've been on. So they invite him to sit around the fire and break the fast and have some food. And so he wants to begin to pray the grace for the food, and they don't know what to say. So he goes ahead himself and he chants the Our Father. And all the way through the Our Father, he says to himself, what the hell have I done? I have made three monks and they don't even know the Our Father. So when he finishes that, he asks them, how come you don't even know the Our Father? He said, oh, we're sorry. We forgot. He realizes they don't know the Gloria Patri. They don't know the creed. They don't know anything. They forgot it all. So he's devastated. He eats. He expresses his mild irritation, which is also about himself, that he has made the monks to do this work, and they've forgotten even the elementary disciplines of the spiritual life. So he says he will come back in the morning. He'll go and sleep on his boat and come back in the morning and teach them. He goes. Takes him a while to get to his boat. Gets in his boat. It's dark, but it's a beautiful night. He tries to sleep. He can't sleep. He has a guilty conscience. What has he done? So he gets up and he sits in his chair and he looks at the stars and he wonders, what have I done? made 3 monks, they don't even know the Our Father. And he's sitting there, and all of a sudden, across the water comes 3 lights. And he looks, where? What is this? There's no lights. This is the 18th century. There's no lights. What's going on? And he sees them coming across, these lights coming across the water. He peers, makes the sign of the cross a few times, just in case. And suddenly he realizes it's the 3 men walking on the water, just like our Lord, walking on the water and coming and stepping inside the boat. And they are all sobbing and saying how sorry they are. They forgot the discipline. The bishop blesses them and goes home in the morning.
Great story.
Well, they had emptied themselves, haven't they?
Thank you very much. They had